Let's get started with what's going on right now in the Middle East. How fragile is the situation right now between Hezbollah and Israel?
I think we've reached the existential phase of this conflict. Israel crossed a red line in murdering Hassan Nasrallah. There's a phrase from, I think it's Matthew 26:52, he who takes up the sword shall perish by the sword. Israel has taken up the sword. Now, I know there's going to be people out there saying, Israel didn't start October 7th. Yeah, they did. They started it back in 1948, and they've been pushing Palestine towards that ever since. Israel continues to occupy part of southern Lebanon, the Sheba Farms, which gives Hezbollah the legitimacy for its continued existence. And Israel has behaved as an out-of-control rogue state for much of its history. One can safely say that with the death of Yitzhak Rabin back in 1995, I believe, that Israel's never been serious about peacefully coexisting with its Palestinian neighbors. So it is what it is. We're entering a phase. I think those people who, are shouting out how Israel has won this war have no clue what war is and no understanding of what happened here. If you're a football coach in the NFL and you think you're going to get to the Super Bowl by using trick plays alone, you'll be sorely disappointed. Trick plays may win one game late in the game, but trick plays do not a winning season make. And what Israel has pulled off in the last couple days, it's a series of trick plays. It looks good. Makes the ESPN highlight reels, pagers going off. Wow, headlines. Who the hell's talking about pagers today? Did it change anything? No. Motorola handheld walkie-talkies going off. Wow. Who's talking about that today? No one. Nasrallah's dead. Wow. You really think that changed anything? You don't think Hezbollah has been preparing for Nasrallah's death ever since Israel was trying to kill him? Israel's been killing the Hezbollah leadership for some time now. Nasrallah took over in 1992 because Israel assassinated the head of Hezbollah. Nasrallah has prepared for this moment. The leadership is prepared. They have lines of succession. This is an organization that has been preparing for the very fight that Israel is now bringing to them since 2006, 18 years. You don't think they've thought through every contingency? Yeah, like I said, a trick play. Oh, pagers going off. Who would have thought about that? No one. So Israel got a cheap headline-grabbing moment, inflicted some casualties. But again, for every Hezbollah person you take out, the resistance organizational structure has somebody already identified to take their place. It's a cellular structure designed to, break apart as necessary. For instance, the Southern Lebanese Front will fight independent of direction from the Hezbollah center under the assumption that Israel would disrupt communications. So it's not as though there's a bunch of fighters right now saying, what do we do? What do we do? What do we do? They know what to do. They've trained for it. They're prepared for it. And they'll execute this operation. Does this mean that everything's hunky-dory for Hezbollah? No, it doesn't. They're being put under a lot of pressure, a lot of stress. But as I said, it's something that Hezbollah has prepared for 18 years. Has Israel prepared for this? You see, I think Hezbollah is one of those fighters that prepares to go into the ring by actually sparring. Meaning not just taking a swing at a heavy bag, but getting hit. Understand what it means to get hit, being prepared to get hit, conditioned to be hit. Israel's not prepared to be hit. Israel is, one of these people who goes in, hits the heavy bag, hits the speed bag, poses in front of mirrors, flexes. But now it's time to get in the ring. We'll find out what they got. I don't know what Israel expected by taking out Hassan Nasrallah, that this would just, lead to automatic victory, the collapse of Hezbollah, the collapse of Iran. Benjamin Netanyahu thinks so, and with his perfect American accent, he addressed the people of Iran. Netanyahu is somehow laboring under the pretense that by murdering Hassan Nasrallah, Hezbollah will collapse, and with it will Iran will as well. I think he's about to find out how resilient the Iranian-led resistance really is. I would have this word of caution for anybody who thinks about taking on Hezbollah and the Iranians. Martyrdom is a thing. And when you're dealing with people who sincerely believe the religious tenets of their faith, and that faith embraces martyrdom as a legitimate outcome, in some cases during jihad, a desirable outcome, killing them ain't going to solve anything. You know, when you cut off the head of the Hydra, three more spring up. And by taking out Nasrallah, all you did is guarantee that somebody stepped in. And that somebody right now is his cousin. He's now the, I can't pronounce his last name, but...
Saif ad-Din.
Okay. He, he was the head of, I mean, it's not as though they pulled him out of nowhere. This is a man who's been literally operating in Hassan Nasrallah's shadows. He's headed up the executive committee of Hezbollah, which means he knows the leadership. He's been on every important decision made, so he knows everything Hassan Nasrallah knows. In fact, I would say that he's actually better prepared to lead Hezbollah right now in this crisis because, as anybody knows, the CEO isn't necessarily the person you go to learn about day-to-day operations of an organization. They have lieutenants, they have deputies to do that. The CEO sits back and issues statements and signs documents and provides guidance. And Nasrallah was the CEO, but the people running the show are different people. And this cousin was one of the people running the show. It's the same thing. They kill the heads of various departments, and it's a serious blow. These guys have corporate knowledge, but to pretend that, you know, the pyramid, the leadership pyramid of Hezbollah is so narrow that when you take out the top, the pyramid collapses is absurd. It's a very broad pyramid. And below each person, there are a dozen or more ready to take their place. And below them are more. This is a true resistance organization, a true guerrilla-style cellular structure. And the idea that you're going to pop a couple bubbles and the whole thing is going to collapse is ludicrous. Is Hezbollah in for a long, difficult period? Absolutely. So is Lebanon. But so too is Israel. And the question now is who can last longer? Lebanon and Hezbollah are conditioned for this fight. They've been in the ring. They've been sparring. They've been punched. Israel, I think, is straight off the couch. A little bit of heavy bag work, a little bit of speed bag work. And now they're told they're getting in the ring with Mike Tyson. Good luck with that.
The president of Iran, Pezeshkian, was talking about after assassination of Ismail Haniyeh. The United States tried to talk with them in order not to attack Israel and giving them some hopes that they're going to make a deal for the benefit of Gazans.
Well, first of all, I understand the United States has lost all credibility. Any credibility it had is gone. I know that the new Iranian president ran on a platform of not wanting to turn away from the West, willing to reach out. And he made some movements in that direction, went to New York, et cetera. And I think it's also clear that Iran and the United States have been engaged for some time now, even going back to Raisi, in back channel negotiations, behind the scenes to prevent what's happening right now, this kind of confrontation. And the United States, all it can bring to bear is promises, that they promise that if Iran does this, if Iran doesn't do that, then the United States will do something. Iran has lived up to every single one of its obligations. When Iran makes a deal, Iran sticks to that deal by the letter. Look at the JCPOA. Iran hasn't violated the JCPOA. Everything Iran does is permitted under the JCPOA. I think it would be interesting to go back and do the public release of the what would be sort of the negotiating talking points, negotiating briefing within the United States about the specific language used in the JCPOA, especially the language that we thought would be used for snapback sanctions that we insisted on putting in there, so that if any party fails to deliver, then the other party can, you know, walk away from its obligations and go back to existing things. And we put in there because we were under the assumption that Iran would violate the JCPOA, that, but in then doing so, we would snap back in sanctions. Well, I'd love to read the Iranian one too, where they're sitting there going, they really want to do this? Because Iran knew it wasn't going to be them that broke it. It should be the United States that broke it. I don't think they expected it to break so soon. Iran always knew that the United States would never live up to the obligations that were inherent in the so-called sunset clauses. Why do they know that? Because Barack Obama said so even before the JCPOA was signed. He said, because someone said, well, what happens when we come to the sunset clauses and you have to start lifting restrictions on Iran's nuclear enrichment program? And Barack said, well, at that time we will reassess and see where we go. Meaning that if the United States didn't get what it wanted from the deal, and what it wanted from the deal were things that weren't part of the deal, they wanted Iran to walk away from nuclear enrichment. The deal allowed them to move to enrichment. We thought we could coerce them away. If we weren't going to get what we wanted outside of the framework, then we would dissolve the framework and start all over. That was Barack Obama that said this. And so the Iranians are going, all right, we like this language. And when Trump withdrew from the JCPOA, Iran said, okay, you're out. Europe's not complying. Therefore, we no longer need to comply because we're relying on, I think it's paragraph 24 and there maybe paragraph 36. I could be wrong on those two paragraphs, but the two paragraphs that allow for this to happen. Iran has complied fully with all of its legal obligations. It's 100% in total compliance with the JCPOA, because the JCPOA no longer has standing, because the members, the European members in the United States withdrew. Guess what happens when you withdraw from an agreement? Your opinion no longer counts. And so Europe said, well, you know, we'd like America to come back, but meanwhile, we're not going to engage fully in the economic activities that we are obligated to do so under the agreement. So Iran went, well, you're not complying. We're not complying. Boom, that's it. And yet now this new president is saying he's willing to sit down and negotiate with the United States about how to, you know, get the JCPOA back to being relevant. I mean, I wouldn't advise him to do that, but I guess, you know, that, and it's a strange move given Iran's pivoting to BRICS and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, this big strategic pivot east. So what it implies, and this is, you know, where what people have to pay attention to, is it implies that there's a domestic political imperative within Iran that says we're not ready to make that big pivot just yet. That there's still an element within the Iranian leadership. Because remember, all during Rafsanjani, all during Khatami, they were trying to make good with the West. They didn't want to make the pivot east. There were a lot of people saying, let's pivot to China, let's pivot to Russia, let's pivot to Eurasia. And the big players, the big economic powerhouses, and Rafsanjani is still huge. And I think they're looking at their investments and saying, you know, one, our investments are going to start to go down here, lose value, because they were all heavily contingent upon maintaining good relations with the West. And there's a whole cast of characters now they're going to challenge us politically, because they're going to become very wealthy by pivoting to the east. And so what I think what you're seeing within Iran is this rearguard action by wealthy established elites that are saying, let's give the West one more chance, one more chance, one more chance. And that was enough. And again, we just have to remember these things. You know, there's a vetting process that takes place before you get your name as a presidential candidate. You know, the Guardian Council has to approve you. And the Guardian Council doesn't operate in a vacuum, meaning that there's somebody up there in the Supreme Leader's inner circle whispering down, going, you can give this guy the green light. You can give this guy the green light. And I think there was sentiment from above that said, we haven't won over the pro-West contingent yet. They're not ready to make the leap. So we need a leader that's willing to at least go through the motions of making that happen. So they got their leader. And this is the stupidity of the United States and Israel. Again, the stupidity of them. Because instead of exploiting this and engaging, even, I mean, look, the United States, we know, doesn't engage in good faith on anything. We know the United States is incapable of being honest. But if you're an American, I would have sat there and said, okay, we know what we want to achieve. But right now we got the Iranians somewhat in a quandary. They want to engage. Let's engage. Let's drag this thing out. Let's drag this thing out. Let's see what we can get out of this. And I would tell the Israelis the same thing. I would have told the Israelis, look, if we drag this thing out, we end up effectively neutralizing Iran because we're going to keep them in a state of limbo. They're not going to decisively engage this way or that way. That'll buy us time for you to close the deal with Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia didn't jump ship to BRICS straight away. Saudi Arabia withheld jumping. They still are considering it, but they haven't made that jump yet, which means Saudi Arabia also has a large group of people inside are saying, we don't want a divorce from the West yet. So we can buy time, muddy the waters, and you, Israel, and Saudi Arabia can close that deal you're looking for. If not outright diplomatic recognition, at least a reconciliation, a normalization of relations that would put in motion the pieces that need to happen for the India Middle East economic corridor, all the things that Israel claims they want. That's the direction they should have gone. They were winning. Hamas took a big gamble by attacking on October 7th. They shot their bolt. That was it. Now they've got no more offensive power. They got a couple rockets, but Iron Dome can take care of that, and some selective bombing can take care of that. And nobody will condemn Israel for bombing Gaza after they've been rocketed. No one will condemn them. You can't. But instead, Israel overreacts, plays in. If Israel had just simply went, wow, that was stupid of you to do, Hamas. We're shutting down all the work applications you had, all those people that were getting income in Israel. We'll never get income again. We're shutting down everything. You're not allowed to come over. The world's not going to go against you for that. How could they? I mean, there'll be the activists that are screaming bloody murder, but they have no standing. Hamas came across the border, attacked Israel, and a bunch of people died as a result. And then Israel just basically lays siege to Gaza. And again, they fire rockets and you bomb. But you don't level entire neighborhoods. You don't kill people. It's just a very selective problem. But you lay siege to Gaza and you get the world community to rally around you. And by doing this, you preserve your diplomatic interaction with Saudi Arabia and the Gulf Arab states, who hate Palestine to begin with and despise Hamas to begin with. And you isolate Hamas. And Hamas withers on the vine because it's got nothing. It did everything to get you to suck into this trap. Don't take the bait. If they'd done that, there'd be normalized relations with Saudi Arabia right now. Palestine would be a defeated entity. Hamas would be done with. There wouldn't be a war on the northern front. Hezbollah's not going to get engaged for that. If Hamas attacks and Israel doesn't overreact, Hezbollah's not going to do anything. They're not going to throw it away. Lebanon wouldn't let them. Politics is a strange thing. So what we have a situation here right now is that we have pushed Iran to where we have lost, I believe, the opportunity to meaningfully engage. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of phone calls going on right now. I know that Netanyahu's trying to call Putin. Why? Well, Putin just dispatched his prime minister to Iran, where things were discussed. Shoigu was just in Iran, where things were discussed. The Russians are literally, they have their finger on the pulse about what Iran's going to do. And again, Russia is heavily vested in Iran's inclusion in the BRICS summit. So there's some desperation here. But again, I just want to ask, why is Netanyahu in a panic trying to reach Putin? I mean, he killed Hassan Nasrallah. What did he think was going to happen? He positioned his forces going into Lebanon. What did he think was going to happen? He continues to bomb Lebanon. Now he bombed the Iranian embassy in Tehran, in Damascus, is the rumor. What did he think was going to happen? Why is he so panicked right now? I think he's panicked because he understands the consequences, that Israel isn't nearly as strong as the posturing has made it out to be. The Israeli military cannot go into southern Lebanon in a meaningful fashion. that globally Israel has no support. There's literally no support for what Israel is doing right now. Israel is the bad guy. They're in the wrong. They didn't get, other than the United States, you don't have everybody jumping up and down saying, good job for killing Nasrallah. Everybody recognized how utterly destabilizing that was. Again, it's hard to predict outcomes because, you know, we're talking about decisions that are going to be existential in nature if they're taken one way or the other, which means it's a life and death struggle.
In the inauguration of the new president of Iran, we had the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh. And when they were in New York talking with Washington and the Zarif team, we know how they're capable, how they're connected with the people in Washington. They wanted to talk with them. And we had the assassination of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah in Lebanon. And right now they're trying to invade, to go with this offensive in Lebanon. Can we conclude that all of these attempts on the part of the Netanyahu administration is to bring in Iran and the United States to make a fight between these two countries?
No, I think we're looking at the wrong thing. I mean, that's a strategic objective that's been the strategic objective of the Netanyahu government for some time now. But Netanyahu is a realist. He knows that Biden in an election year isn't going to war with Iran. You know, it just isn't going to happen unless Iran massively attacks the United States. That would be the end of the Kamala Harris candidacy. It just because the consequences that already we saw just over the threat of missiles hitting Israel, we saw the price of oil jack up $3 a barrel instantly. Damn, why didn't I show you? Why didn't I buy oil? And if it's an all-out war, you're going to see the price of oil go through the roof. And when that happens, for Biden, this is, let's just put this way. There's a longshoreman strike taking place right now in the United States, shutting down all the ports. If this strike continues, in 2 weeks, this country is going to be in economic chaos heading into the Christmas holidays. I mean, it's literally the kiss of death. For it. Go back to James Carville, 1992, the message he put on the door to the Clinton war room. It's the economy, stupid. That's all you need to be focused on right now. The economy, the economy, the economy. The last thing the Biden administration wants to be doing is getting engaged in a war it can't win against Iran. The consequences of a regional conflict that had disrupted global energy supplies is catastrophic for both the European economy that's already on the verge of collapse. You start jacking up energy prices, and that's the end of Europe rolling into a wintertime. This is why Olaf Scholz is trying frantically talking about getting a phone call with Putin, because he realizes the game's up, man. It's over. You want to watch the political revolution that's taking place in Europe finish the job. These far-right parties, conservative parties, that are, you know, against what the, you know, leftists and the Greens have done to Europe in the aftermath of the special military operation. Jack up the price of oil. Make life impossible to live. Make businesses impossible to function in Europe. And that's the end of Europe. It's the end of the Biden administration. I mean, they're a lame duck, but they're hoping to, you know, have Kamala Harris take over. Not with $12 a gallon oil of gas. Not with people unable to fill up their oil reservoirs in lead up to winter. It's the last thing that they need. And this will be the, you know, energy spike, price spike combined with longshoreman strike. It's over. Game, set, match. So the Biden administration isn't leaning towards a war, and Netanyahu knows that. This is all about Netanyahu. Nima, remember, 2 weeks ago, how many Israelis were in the street protesting against Benjamin Netanyahu and the hostage deal? Hundreds of thousands. Has that problem gone away? No. Still there. Like I said, he did some trick plays. Everybody's talking about the trick play, except the trick plays didn't change anything strategically. The hostages are still held in Gaza. They ain't coming home until there's a ceasefire. That's a reality. Netanyahu cannot have a ceasefire and survive under the current conditions. So he's distracting. He's going into Lebanon and distracting. But he knows, again, trick plays don't change things. Israel couldn't invade Lebanon this entire time. Why? They don't have the military for it. How many times have you heard Israeli generals say, we can't do this. We don't want to do this. I mean, we said it 2 weeks ago, and everybody's like, yeah, no, Israel can't. But now, because some pagers blew up, everybody's going, no, Israel can go in the southern Lebanon. Israel can go in the south. No, they can't. And they're not. Look what they're doing. These are tiny little raids into going in just a little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit here, just to say, oh, we went in. We did a special forces raid. We put a tank across the border. And what's Hezbollah doing? Hitting downtown Tel Aviv, hitting Haifa, hitting the Israeli troop concentrations. This is in what? Israel's going to go full in. I just want to remind people that I think it's called the Radwan Brigade. I might be wrong on this, but it's the big brigade that's responsible for defending Lebanon south of the Litani River. They have not been destroyed. They are still physically intact. And they have been training for 18 straight years for this fight. They know the ground better than anybody. They've thought through every tactical engagement point. There's only so many, when you have a Merkava tank, there's only so many ways you can enter southern Lebanon. Geography dictates that. And as you enter, it's generally speaking in a alluvial plain surrounded by hills moving into a valley. I think Hezbollah has plotted all this out. They have barriers in place, mine barriers. They can install new mine barriers. They've thought this out. So if Israel gets sucked in, it's a death trap. That's the reality of it. That's why Israel, I don't believe, is going to go into southern Lebanon in a massive invasion, because they can't. That doesn't mean that they won't, because again, this is all about preserving Benjamin Netanyahu's political legacy. Everything that's happening here is designed to keep him in a government whose existence is dependent upon war. And so he will keep stretching and stretching and stretching and stretching the envelope to keep this conflict. What he's looking for is the miracle. What he's looking for is to emerge from all of this as a victor. That's why he did all the trick plays. I mean, he blew up the pagers and he killed Hassan Nasrallah. That would have been a good time to say I'm victorious, but now he's going for the big show. He's going to collapse Iran, collapse Hezbollah, and bring the 60,000 settlers home. And nobody's talking about Gaza right now because it's all focused on the big show in Lebanon, Hezbollah, the big threat. And we're going to, I think, again, I don't think the trick plays fundamentally harmed Hezbollah. I think when Israel decisively engages, it will not go well for Israel. It doesn't mean it's going to be easy for Hezbollah. Israel is a very capable military. I mean, they have an air force that, is not being effectively challenged. But they had that air force in 2006 and they lost. We'll find out what happens in the coming days. But, the United States, Biden can't afford to have a major war right now. But he also, this is where Netanyahu has him by the short and curlies, because Biden can't do what's necessary to get Israel to change its course of action. He can't stop the weapons supplies. He can't cut off aid. He can't do the standard things. I mean, there's a number of ways that this could end right now. But no politician seeking re-election has the courage to do what's necessary to change Israel's course of action, Netanyahu's course of action.
Yeah. And we had, Scott, a joint Russian-Syrian air raid on Idlib. And what was the reason behind that? And what are the activities in that region that was of concern for Russia?
What, say the first part of that sentence?
In Idlib. They were attacking Idlib.
What's in Idlib? Terrorists, Wahhabists, Al Qaeda. This is, again, people don't give Russia the credit that Russia deserves. The Russians came in and saved Al Assad And I know there's a whole coterie of people out there who are like, Assad's a brutal murderer, a war criminal, this, that. Kiss my ever-loving butt. All right? You know who's a war criminal? ISIS, Al-Qaeda, CIA-backed so-called Free Syrian Army. These are outside perpetrators, actors coming in trying to change the regime of perhaps the most popular president Syria's ever had. You watch this guy walk down the streets of Damascus. Okay, he is loved, deeply loved. And that's not an Alawite community that he's walking down the streets. That's a Syrian community with, you know, Sunni, Shia, Alawites, Christians. They're all there. They love this man. They love this man because he has stood by them and he's dragged them through, you know, gotten them out of the gates of hell with the help of Russia. Russia intervened to prevent the black flag of Wahhabism from flying over Damascus. And they succeeded. The Russians then went around and did some interesting things. They brought in their military police. I always say that the Nobel Committee should give the Peace Prize to Russian military police for what they've done in Syria, because they've gone into a situation where, you know, Islamist extremists are not going to talk to the Syrian government. They're not going to talk to them. The Russians came in, separated the two, and then negotiated a deal where these extremists and their families could be evacuated to Idlib, thereby liberating much of the territory around Damascus in southern Syria from this anti-regime entities. But now they're up in Idlib. Idlib was an area that it's the birthplace of Dara. In the south is where the original riots took place. But if you want the big fighting, it took place up in Idlib. I think it's Jisr al-Shagir is the name of the town that the original fighting took place. There's just that province has been taken over by Al-Qaeda, by al-Nusra. ISIS, I mean, every time al-Baghdadi was hanging out in Idlib, when he got killed. So, it's a place full of bad people. The Turks have come in. They've created, a buffer zone that they've populated it with radical Uyghurs that they were able to coax out of China, bring in, train. There's a huge Uyghur population right now in Idlib. These are people who carry out horrific acts of terrorism and violence against anybody who opposes them. And, Russia's there to help the Syrian government regain sovereignty over the totality of its territory. And so you have this al-Nusra front, you have these al-Qaeda elements, launching attacks against the Syrian government, against the Russians, and the Russians respond. And so, Russia drops bombs on these people because they want to weaken them. They want to demoralize them. They want to create the conditions where they will be compelled to either flee Syria, but nobody's going to take them, or die, which Russia's willing to help them do, or make an agreement with the Syrian government and try to reintegrate into society. And there are some elements there that can do that. There are some who will never be allowed to do that. And that becomes Turkey's problem. But I don't think Turkey wants to absorb radical Islamists. And so ultimately, at the end of the day, there's a certain element, a certain number of people in Idlib, they're going to have to die. That's just the reality of it. The situation is such that we've put the most evil people on the planet in a very tight space, and there's nowhere left for them to go. And so they're going to die. And Russia's going to help them die by dropping bombs on them. It's tragic. It's not a desirable outcome, but again, blame the United States. We're the ones that poured the money. We're the ones that empowered Turkey, encouraged Turkey to do this. Blame Turkey. Erdogan made a huge strategic error in turning his back on the friendship that he had with Bashar al-Assad. He went with the gamble that Assad was going to fall in 2012, 2013, and that Erdogan would be able to assert Turkish sovereignty over the Vilayet of Aleppo, where Idlib is adjacent to that, but, take over this territory, northern Syria would become Turkey again, part of the, greater Turkey, just like he has visions of, the Vilayet of Mosul somehow returning to Turkey. It was a gamble. It failed. failed miserably. And now, you know, he's left dealing with the consequences of this. And Russia's not going to let the pressure up. Russia's not going to allow the situation in Idlib, in Syria's not either, to become sort of the status quo. They want this thing resolved. Bashar al-Assad wants to have control over all of Syria. That includes not just Idlib, but also the areas in northwestern Syria where the United States and Turkey are occupying. This isn't going to happen unless continued pressure is brought to bear on those who are illegally occupying or illegally residing on Syrian sovereign Syrian territory.